Architecture forgot to build one critical thing, its own support system. That operational chaos you feel every day, it's why your best people burn out. Why project fees get eaten up from design conflicts being discovered during construction. You have projects not making any profit, and why you're still working after your family is asleep. That's the daily chaos most architecture firms face because practical training is missing from the start. Hi, I'm Caitlin Rosier, an architect on a mission to fix this. The Mentor Dino Academy is your firm's secret weapon for giving you your time back and boosting your bottom line. It's the training system that bridges the knowledge gap, helping your teams master the skills they need to work smarter, reduce costly mistakes, and build a more profitable firm. Stop the chaos. Visit MentorDino.com to learn more. The Academy is the tool to fix the chaos, and this podcast is where we share stories and perspectives that inspire a better way forward.
Hello, and welcome to the Mentor Dino podcast. I'm your host, Caitlin Rosier. I am an architect and founder of Mentor Dino. Join me each week as I speak with amazing professionals in and around the architecture, engineering, and construction industry, as we are all part of a larger interconnected community. We discuss everything from career stories, lessons learned, and advice for others finding their own unique career path. Thank you to all of our current subscribers, and if you're new, welcome to the conversation. And if you like this episode, please do me a favor by hitting subscribe, like, or share it with a friend. It really helps others be able to discover this resource and support them on their own unique career journey.
On today's episode of the Mentor Dino podcast, I would like to welcome Jessica Stuck, Associate and Senior Project Manager at LGA Partners in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Thank you, Jessica, for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks for having me.
So I always like starting out with my loaded question, if you don't mind introducing yourself to my listeners to let them know a little bit about your experience and journey so far in your education and your career.
Sure. So I was born in Ohio, grew up in Massillon, Ohio, ended up going to Kent State for architecture. I also have another, undergrad degree in history as well. And then I stayed at Kent State and got my master of architecture, before going to Albany, New York and working for John G. Waite and Associates, which is a historic preservation firm. And then ended up coming back to Pittsburgh and working for Perfido, Weisskopf, Wagstaff, and Gettle, before then doing a sabbatical, I like to call it a sabbatical, in DC, for a firm called Quinn Evans, working in their, heritage studio, and then ended up coming back to Pittsburgh because I love it so much, and worked at MCF Architects, before taking a position with Landmarks SGA, which is a firm that is associated with a landscape architecture firm that focuses on brownfield redevelopment. So my focus throughout my whole career has been historic preservation, adaptive reuse of existing buildings. And a lot of time on brownfield sites, you have existing buildings that either have hazardous materials like asbestos or lead paint, or have perceptions of hazardous materials, and that qualifies them as brownfield sites. So a lot of the work I did there was through the US EPA, and involved projects that, you know, were seeking funding through historic tax credits. And then just recently, we created a partnership. I don't know if it's called a partnership. we entered into a strategic alliance with LGA Partners, another national architecture firm that's headquartered in Pittsburgh, and that's where I am now.
Yeah, this isn't a legal podcast, yeah. So the wording and partnerships, but I am going to start using your word sabbatical, though. Because I know a little bit more details on your journey, because we've known each other since Kent.
But I'm going to start using the word sabbatical on my little sabbatical I had. So,
yeah.
So did your passion for adaptive reuse and preservation come from studying history? Like, how did you figure out that could be a specialty?
I think I have two ways I could describe where my passion came from. So I think from a technical perspective, yeah, my interest in history definitely got me to where I am, because I came into school, into college with a lot of AP credits from high school, a lot in, you know, AP history, AP government, things like that. So when I looked at options for a second major, history was the one that made the most sense because I was interested in it and I had a lot of credits that I already didn't need to take additional classes in college. And then, you know, as I was getting out of college after I had my master's degree and applying to different jobs, I think that's what helped me get my first position. It was 2013, so it wasn't as bad as, I guess, the economy in 2008 and the situation for trying to get jobs in the field of architecture. But it definitely wasn't the best time to be graduating college and trying to find a job. And I really think that my interest in history was what propelled me to interview and get the job at John G. Waite in Albany.
Yeah, I know, because I was right after you. So it was, you know, you get one job offer and you're like, done. Guess that's where I'm going.
Yeah. But the warm and fuzzy story that I have for like why I was interested in preservation and adaptive reuse is when I was in sixth grade, there was a school board levy for new middle schools for our school district. And so I had just gotten into this new middle school, which is like a three-story brick 1923 building, probably neoclassical, but really, really vernacular, stripped down. It was very plain, but it had a lot of problems and needed a lot of upgrades. And I wrote a letter to the editor explaining that we needed new buildings because it was interrupting my education or something like that. And so I wrote the letter. They ended up passing the levy, probably not because of my letter, but then they tore down the building. And to this day, the site where the building was is an empty lot. It never was redeveloped. Like, and I just look at that and think there was so much potential for what they could have done with the school. Besides just tear it down and leave an empty lot that's, you know, it's been 30 years and the lot hasn't been redeveloped and nothing has gone on there. So it sort of makes me sad that I was pushing so hard that we needed new schools, because they probably just could have done some really good upgrades and made the buildings work.
Yeah. I always feel like we're too quick to just demo things and then move on. It's, you know, a lot of buildings have some really good bones that, you know, either the owners didn't have time to take care of it or the business moves out or anything. And it's like, well, you can repurpose that space and use it for something else or be able to upgrade it, upgrade the efficiencies, use it in a different way. So,
yeah. Or it could have been one of those stories where they turn, you know, schools into apartment buildings or senior housing or something like that. There's so many uses and it's just like sad because it's an empty lot.
Yeah. But I know also with even some of my research on firms, whenever like everybody lists like all the different project types and everything that they offer, sometimes when I see that somebody denotes preservation and adaptive reuse, it ends up being like a sidebar and not their main thing. So if somebody's looking to do more preservation, adaptive reuse, do you have advice for finding those firms that really are highlighting that work and doing like, so they have significant opportunities to actually do that project type and not get in and be like, oh, I guess you don't actually do that much work. So,
yeah. I think this is interesting. I used to, I guess I didn't talk about it, but I was an adjunct professor at Kent State and I taught an introduction to preservation class. And I know that a lot of the students that took it, it was just an elective to get their credits to graduate. But I told them that regardless if they go into a preservation specific field or not, that they were going to be dealing with historic buildings or just at least existing buildings based on the building stock that's exist, right? So you're right. There are all these firms that they do historic preservation, whether, you know, they intended to or not, or they work with existing buildings, I should say. Mm-hmm. So, you know, finding a firm that actually does the preservation can be difficult, or that does it, you know, and has a good grasp on the Secretary of the Interior standards, can be difficult. I was, I guess, lucky that the first firm I went to was really a historic preservation firm, truly. And I was able to learn how to do it. But I would say there are non-typical firms that probably can provide preservation skills. Like there's a lot of like Wish Janney or Simpson Gumperts and Hegger, which are like building envelope consultants. Mm-hmm. That really are more technical preservation related to the building envelope. Obviously, maybe not so much on historic interiors, but you know, there's those kinds of firms for people that are interested. And then otherwise, you know, I would probably, I don't know, look at social media, look at who's winning the awards. Like there's preservation awards. You know, statewide, local preservation awards, national preservation awards, try and look at the firms that are doing that and reach out. But yeah, I do think it's, even if you aren't doing like high preservation, even working at a firm where you do get the opportunity to work on existing buildings is still good experience in the right direction.
Yeah, I know a lot of my experience has been more test fits and renos of existing spaces, and they have their own challenges that, you know, when I jump to do a new build, I'm like, there's all this space. What do? We don't have these like constraints besides, you know, zoning and setbacks, but then that's so light and fluffy compared to existing buildings themselves and dealing with existing structures, systems, and exteriors if the budget doesn't really allow to touch the exterior. So has there been additional unexpected challenges whenever you're doing a preservation type project versus more of that fit out work replacement?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's technical challenges, obviously, with unknown conditions or conditions that are uncovered. Thankfully, like the more experience you get working with buildings of a certain age or similar construction types, you're able to be preemptive about it. And, you know, now I can look at a wall and sort of assume like, oh, it's probably structural clay tile, or it's a brick masonry three wide bearing wall or something like that. Where, you know, if you're earlier in your career and maybe you're not aware of some of these archaic building assembly types, you might not be able to do that. So that's always a challenge because there's always surprises that you can't ever anticipate. But I think the perception is the biggest challenge, especially in markets where people aren't used to spending money, like where value engineering is what everybody needs to do because of budgets and, you know, cost overruns and things like that. But, you know, trying to convince a client that this is the best route to take and it's the best way that they can be a steward to their building is oftentimes very difficult, because it's hard to raise the funding to do that. It's hard to find the people who are skilled to do the work that you want them to do. And then just in general, the idea of preservation has such a negative connotation. I've had to do public meetings a lot for the last 2.5 years in the position I was in. And I've gone to so many public meetings where there's somebody there that's just like, it's going to cost 50% more because you want us to follow these standards. And it's like, maybe, but also maybe not. And also, you know, there's things like historic tax credits, which could potentially offset any kind of additional funding that might be necessary to follow the Secretary of the Interior standards. So I think perception really is probably the biggest one. And mostly everybody has, not everybody, a lot of people have negative perceptions of when you say the term preservation.
I wouldn't have expected so much negativity with it. I know people are, you know, even just thinking of like the residential side, and it's, you know, people are more apt to just, okay, I just want to build new and not deal with an existing home. And I'm like, well, if existing home is good bones, they don't build that way anymore. That quality of work, like I just did a partial renovation of my house, and it's like you find stuff that I'm like, well, that wasn't done right, but I can fix it. But you even look at the stud construction, because part of my house is 100 years old, and it's like the studs are even bigger and you can see the grains, and it's like, okay, I'm not even in a masonry home, but even the wood construction's different. I'm like, the quality is better from back then versus now. So it's, everybody just wants everything new, strip everything down, start fresh. And
yeah. But I mean, yeah, I think it's a good point, because there's this perception that I have an old house. I'm going to have to continue doing like maintenance every day. Something's going to break every day because it's old, and that's what's going to happen. But my brother has a house that was built 3 years ago, and he's probably had to do more on his house than I've had to do on mine, which was built in the 1920s. So
yeah,
there is a perception, and it's not necessarily true. But it's something that we face with all of our projects, to make sure that we're being the best stewards to the existing building that we can be, but also working within the budget constraints of the clients.
Yeah. And so are you typically partnering with specialty envelope professionals, like some of those consultants that can come in and really dive into the detailed construction of the envelope versus the preservation side? Like, how does that work when you start bringing in those technical experts?
Yeah, I mean, I've done both. So it really is, I think the significance of the building might warrant like certain experts. So the Allegheny County Courthouse, I worked on the feasibility study or the facilities plan for that project back in 2014. And we had a sub consultant, which was Simpson, Gumperts and Hager, SGH, out of their DC office. And they're, you know, one of the, you know, premier building envelope firms, especially related to historic preservation. And so we had them as a sub-consultant, and we worked hand in hand, where a lot of what they did was the testing portion of it. So, you know, they would come out and do, you know, mortar testing or something like that for the masonry, or for the clay tile roof, they would do pull-out testing. And they would provide recommendations, and then we were the architect of record. And then we would, you know, not design the detail, but we would draft the detail, and they would review it before anything went out. So, you know, I've done that with probably more landmark projects. And then on some smaller projects where there's not much of a budget for it, you know, I've been capable of doing it in-house based on my experience and then the experience of the team.
Yeah. Have you had a favorite project or one that, like, you know, in the end you're like, yes, we did it.
I think, you know, the Allegheny County Courthouse is my favorite project, because so we did the facilities plan, which basically outlined, you know, projects for the next 25 years that the county could undertake to make improvements to the building. And then we actually started with the replacement of the roof and masonry restoration. So, you know, that the roof on the courthouse before we did the replacement, everybody thought it was slate because there was so much soot from 100 years of pollution. And we were able to actually get up into the attic and see that the roof was actually like the red orange color that you see on it now. And it was a crazy transformation to see that now. And just, you know, learning that building and like understanding the original plans for the design, like there were supposed to be air washers. They were supposed to bring water in from, or not, they were supposed to bring polluted air in the tower, the bell tower. And then they had two smaller towers in the courtyard. So the air was supposed to flow down the tower into the basement, be washed by air, like water washers, to take the
like human washers.
No, they were like they were mechanical, like some sort of mechanism in the basement. I don't know if it ever. Nobody knows if it was ever actually like working? Or if it was actually useful. But the idea was that the air would go through the water, and the water would take out the soot and the pollution from the air, and it would be recirculated through the building.
Hmm.
So it was pretty ingenious if it worked. But it's obviously has not been working for the past, at least since we got in there, it wasn't operational. But just the ideas that they had to try and clean the air at a time when, you know, at noon, it looked like it was midnight in downtown Pittsburgh.
Yeah, a very different Pittsburgh that I know everybody gets the perception that we still can't see and the air hasn't cleaned since the steel ages. But
yeah,
no, that's fascinating. Now I kind of want to go to the courthouse and just go on an adventure. Just be like, I need to see this.
I did a whole presentation on it for Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation in, 2018 or 2017. But that was back when it was on the top of my brain and all the information was fresh.
Yeah. I know when I did a skyscraper downtown, we got to the bottom of a giant supply air shaft, or no, it was the return, and they didn't have it closed off at the bottom. Like one, I needed to close it off for code, but you looked up and you just saw, it was just black the entire way up between when you could smoke inside this building and everything. And I'm like, okay. Then you finally could see where they added so many filters, but I'm like, ugh. I'm like, okay, I'm glad I don't work in this building, but you just see what, you know, humans have done to different structures and stuff over the years, how we've worked or utilized them. So, but on a different note, I want to jump to the sabbatical. And now that I'm talking in those sense, I know we had a conversation a number of years back when I even hit a moment where I felt like I realized I was at a company that I shouldn't have shifted over to, and trying to find a fit that works is hard, and trying to find a firm that the culture aligns when you're trying to just express how good you are and you're trying to be positive and be in a different situation. And so that's why I joke now that the sabbaticals are, you know, jump to a firm and then it's, oh, this isn't what I was expected, or this wasn't what I was led to believe this position to be for what I wanted to jump into. So do you have any advice for those that may be experiencing that they've jumped to a firm that is not what they expected? And I know a lot of advice is stick it out for a year. And that's when we had our last conversation about it.
Yeah. Well, so I think, you know, at the time when I had my sabbatical, I was 6 years into the field, maybe something around then. If I had just been out of school and, you know, this is your first job or something like that, I think the stick it out for a year makes sense, because you're probably not only adjusting to having a professional career, but then also adjusting to switching from school and that construct to whatever your construct is at your firm. But, you know, if you've had that experience working in a firm and you've taken the step to go to another firm and, you know, you feel something isn't right, I would say to trust your gut. Obviously, you know, it's your career. And if you have a plan for your career and you feel that something doesn't feel right, there's no shame in making a move. And I think I told you that a lot of the places that I spoke with when I was trying to make the jump back from my sabbatical, they really respected that. I know a lot of people have a stigma that it's a negative thing to have gaps on your resume, or to, you know, go someplace for 6 months and then leave. But if you really know what you want in your career, you have to trust yourself. And the whole process of interviews and getting jobs is like a 1 hour conversation minimum, right? Or a couple 1 hour conversations where you're trying to show the best of yourself and the firm is trying to show the best of themselves. And nobody's really gonna be able to understand what the firm life is gonna be. There's so many variables in firm culture, firm management style, project types, even location, that you have to understand for yourself what you want to do. And then the firm also has to have their business model and make money and be successful as well. So finding a firm that aligns with your career path and where you want to go in your career is not as easy as a 2-hour conversation, right? So you can get it wrong. There's tons of firms. There's a lot of people. Some firms are a right fit for some people. Some firms aren't. And, you know, if you've had experience and you know what you want to do and it doesn't feel right, there should be no shame in it. I think there's an antiquated view of loyalty or something like that, where when people did get out of school, they got a job and they stayed at that job until they retired. And that's not really the way that the industry is going these days. And it's not really the way that any kind of profession really is going these days. And so I don't think it's as bad of a stigma as it used to be. But regardless, why stay in a situation that you know is negative towards your own mental health or well-being or career path when you can move and make it better?
Yeah, and keep an eye out for opportunities. I know when I jumped into a position, it was just, I went from one burnout to another. I went from overwork burnout to almost a boredom burnout, and learning the two extremes. But then when you're bored and sitting around, you can really see kind of the faces behind the organization, and you don't get like heads down on a project to kind of skip over it. But it definitely depends on who you talk to. But I agree, when you first come out of school, you got to just dig your teeth in and see what the industry is like, because it's so much different than studio. Mm-hmm. But you also can't jump around every year either, or else you'll never see a project from start to finish. So I know when I left after 6 months of a company, I knew when I was looking for that next job, I needed something that I'm going to, you know, really hold on to for a while and not do a bunch of jumps. But I don't regret leaving in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I don't have any regrets at this point. I think, you know, it was a good experience. Like, it was good to be able to go and be like, okay, maybe I don't want to be living in DC, which was part of the decision. Maybe I like Pittsburgh, and maybe that's where I want to be. So it helps you figure out what your priorities are, I think, when you have a situation like that you have to deal with.
Yeah. And you've jumped around to a couple cities because you were up in Albany, Pittsburgh, and DC. So how is it looking for jobs when you jump cities?
I mean, it's difficult. Obviously, I had a connection when I was, well, I guess in all situations, I had a connection, right? So when I was in college, I actually interned in Pittsburgh. So I had a connection to the city from the firm that I interned with. So when I was leaving Albany, I at least had that firm that I could talk to. That's not the firm I ended up at. But I was comfortable with the city. I had friends in the city. So it didn't, it wasn't a bad experience. I don't think it, the only thing was like the physical proximity, right? Mm-hmm. Making sure that you are very organized and, you know, I need to take PTO so that I can go interview, and making sure that you get your interview scheduled for all the places that you want to talk to. That part of it, the logistics was the hardest part, but you know, I had a connection with each place, and obviously from DC coming back to Pittsburgh was very simple because I still had my house here. That part, it wasn't so bad.
Yeah. And I don't know if back then, if you had to do more in-person interviews, so it's even flights, or as now so much, even if you're already local, it's, all right, I'm doing interviews for summer interns. I'm like, well, half of you guys are already in Pittsburgh and I'm still doing it virtually and not bringing somebody to an office half the time.
Yeah, they were all, I mean, after an introductory call, the actual interviews were all in person at that point. So
yeah,
a different world.
Then it's really scheduling PTO and it's like, oh, let me go take this really long weekend trip.
Yeah, thankfully, when I was in Albany and moving back to Pittsburgh, one of my friends was getting married. So I was coming back for like bachelorette parties and then the wedding. So I was able to schedule like a little bit longer PTO to fit in some interviews.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I need to party some more, take a break. I couldn't get a flight to come back early.
Yeah.
And I know in the most recent transition, shifting over to LGA, I know you were more of a principal role at Landmarks and then switching over to more of a senior project manager. So how was that transition for you? I know I tend to ignore titles in people, but I'm not sure. How's that role change? Because I see it more leadership and getting work versus PM still the client side, but you're not as much onus on bringing in the work. So
yeah. So it's difficult. So it's not difficult. It's a different situation. So Landmarks, we were a firm of four people. So there were four architectural staff, but my partners were landscape architects. So at the time, I was the only practicing architect. So I was doing the business development, the marketing, the administration, you know, finances, invoicing, but also managing projects. So it was a lot, mm-hmm. even though it was a firm of four people. And we had significant amount of work, which made it even more stressful because obviously, you know, trying to figure out what to prioritize when you are in a leadership position and an owner of the firm. So I'm still on the leadership team at LGA Partners. I'm an associate. So I still have, administrative, operational, business development, marketing activities and responsibilities. But I'm able to focus more on the project management side of things. And I think, you know, I enjoy both, but it allows me to not only have an ability to expand the capability and resources up to 80 plus staff members who are now all my colleagues. But to have some more mentorship from the other leadership team members and the senior associates and the partners, which I really felt like I was sort of stranded on an island being the only architect owner of Landmarks. So I really am excited about the opportunity to have that ability to not have people to fall back on, but just have more people to discuss things with that sort of understand that specialty of architecture rather than just the AE field.
Yeah, and you're not just throwing a dart at the wall at some things.
Yeah, because obviously I'm still young. So, you know, being an owner of a company and I don't have all the answers to these things. And so it's nice to now be in a position where I can ask other people and they've had the experience and they're willing to share and mentor me. So I get more experience as well. So I don't really care about the titles. Mm-hmm. I think one of those conversations I had, I said, I just want to do good projects and I want to, you know, serve the clients well and have really cool projects that we can showcase and that we can be proud of. And honestly, you know, with a staff of four people, you can't really do larger projects. So I'm excited about the opportunity to continue doing some larger projects because, you know, we were just so limited in our capabilities due to the staff size. So it really is going to open up a lot of new doors that I'm excited about.
Yeah, I know I stopped looking at titles. I think the first time I did the Pittsburgh Equity Report, and it was so confusing when people had so many different titles, but each firm, that title means something like ever so slightly different. And so, and they're not equals as you jump firm to firm. So yeah. I was like, I don't know. When I pull out titles, I'm like, I guess this is what they're doing, but I'm like, yeah, you always have to just ask.
Yeah. But, and also like titles don't matter. Like everybody's important to a project, right? So like, regardless if you're, you know, somebody that's right out of school, that's, you know, maybe just working on details or just redlining a set or something like that. Like that's just as important as the principal in charge of a project. So it really, I don't know. Obviously the goal is to have a career trajectory and move up for some people, but I think it's not really that big of a deal in the grand scheme of things. So.
Yeah. No, when I interviewed, Bob Bailey on my podcast, I know I asked him about leadership roles and taking on different responsibility. And his advice was to be sure you know that's what you want and don't just assume that you have to go in that path. So have you learned from that like glimpse of a principal role that you'd want to be principal again, but potentially different size firm?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely enjoyed it. And I don't know. I guess I'm figuring out what my path is. Like, I still enjoy working on the projects. And I think I'm a really skilled project manager. But I also think I enjoyed aspects of the being a principal and an owner of a firm. You know, I know my weaknesses are in the business development sphere and networking. So that's something I know that I need to work on if I want to get back to that position at some point. But yeah, I still think it's in the cards for me at some point.
Yeah. No, I was just curious because not that many people get like that experience glimpse of that type of role. They'll, you know, be tangent to another principal, like either doing BD, but having that experience and jumping all in and then being able to step back is very unique to be like, okay, here's where I'm lacking now that I have bandwidth time again to like up my skill set again. So,
yeah, I will say it's a stressful thing to be an owner in a firm and know that people's livelihoods depend on you. And, you know, definitely, I'm glad to not be there at this moment. Glad I was able to successfully, you know, get all the employees and maintain their employment. But it's a scary thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's beyond just your own, like, willpower and skill to get something done. And it goes into, okay, I need to make sure they have money for mouths to feed and family and lives that they have. So not easy. Yeah. But jumping to the community side of preservation. So with preservation, old buildings, adaptive reuse, I know you've also name dropped the Landmarks Association of Pittsburgh. So besides that organization, or we can jump into that one, what type of organizational opportunities are there for those that want to specialize in preservation?
Yeah. I mean, so I think there's a lot. So on the community side of things, if you live in a historic district, there's a lot of like different historic societies. So for example, like Mexican War Streets, if you live in the Mexican War Streets, they have the Mexican War Streets Society, which is a group of individuals that are excited about the preservation of the houses in the Mexican War Streets. And each of the, I don't know if each of them, but a lot of times if you're in a location that has a historic district, there's also a community organization that you can get involved in that way. The city of Pittsburgh has the Historic Review Commission. A lot of, you know, cities and municipalities have historic review commissions or historic review boards, which are regulated by ordinance. And the ordinances typically require that the board has non-architects. You know, sometimes they'll say like you need to have a real estate agent, an architect, a historian, or just like a resident. So even if you aren't like a preservationist or even not even an architect, you can still get involved in that way and serve on your historic review board if you're in a city that has one. But then there's also state organizations. So for the state of Pennsylvania, there's Preservation Pennsylvania. And there's the State Historic Preservation Office, which is, there's one in each state. The one in Pennsylvania is the Pennsylvania Historical and Museum Commission. And so, I mean, that's more of a policy and an entity at the state level, not necessarily community involvement. But they have good resources to be able to look at, you know, different ways you can get involved if you're interested in preservation. There's also more technical professional organizations like the Association for Preservation Technology is a group that I'm a part of, the Delaware Valley chapter, which includes Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. So you can always become a member of that at the regional level and the national level or international level. It's an international organization. So I think there's a lot of different ways. So, you know, I think if you want to get involved at the local level, look for those local historic groups or neighborhood groups that might be interested in preservation. But then there's other opportunities as well. Preservation Pennsylvania and the National Trust for Historic Preservation are probably also, you know, from a state and then his national level, two good ones to check out.
Yeah. Are they always looking for, I guess I see it at two levels, like you almost need an expert in some of those groups and then almost more of a novice learner. So like, could somebody come in as, you know, even if you're studying for the exams, like technically you're just a resident, you're not a licensed architect yet, you're not like a professional that, like, I wouldn't call myself a historic preservation architect, but if I wanted to learn about it, could you equally get in to those organizations that way as a learning opportunity?
Yeah, I think especially on the historic review boards, you don't necessarily need the expertise or the professional mm-hmm. like licensure, even though there's not like licensure. But yeah, it could just be, you know, architects or non-preservationists or any level could get involved in that way. And I know a lot of different municipalities, not necessarily the city of Pittsburgh, but some smaller municipalities that have these historic districts and review boards are always looking for volunteers. So I think it's a good way to understand some of the historic district guidelines and the standards for preservation by being involved in that. There's also groups like the Young Preservationists. I don't know what the real term is. Young Preservationists Association. So YPA of Pittsburgh, which is also a group that includes historians, it includes architects, it includes regular people that are just interested in promoting preservation. They have their top 10. They have their top 10 list that they do every year of like the most endangered sites in Pittsburgh. And then they try and bring attention to those sites and hopefully get them redeveloped or preserved or saved in some way. And I know they've been successful for some. So that's also a really good organization locally that people could get involved in. And I'm sure a similar format exists in different cities across the country.
Yeah. Then the organization that you're part of that you're more regional, but they do have an international component. I always have a fun time when I talk to friends and family that live or are from Europe, and we always joke it's either American old or real old in terms of everything in Europe, just having been around for so much longer versus the stateside. It's more, oh, that's still a new building compared to the Europeans' mindset. So have there been conversations in that group about that, or have you run into any of those fun things?
Yeah, so I would say that even though this group is international, it's Association for Preservation Technology International, a lot of what our focus on is Canada, United States. It's more like North America.
Yeah.
I don't want to say that. I don't want them to get mad at me. But, you know, a lot of our conferences are, you know, either in Canada or the northeast of the U.S. They've been in other places, too. But that seems to be the focus. There are some truly international organizations like ICOMOS and some other ones that have probably had those conversations more frequently. but I don't know. At some point, everything's going to get old. So hopefully we'll preserve our buildings so that we can get to the point of having like thousands of years old structures in the United States.
Yeah. I know that's just the fun conversations I have on the side. So
yeah.
but I always like wrapping up my podcast with this final question, and it's, what advice do you have for young professionals just starting their career?
It's a good question. I think, you know, speaking from my experience, is find what you're passionate about and then become the expert in it. So one of the things that I think helped me stand out when I was graduating college was having this history degree and this interest in history, which probably set me apart from other people that were applying that might just have had an architecture degree. So I think throughout my entire career, that expertise has really helped me, you know, have job opportunities and have opportunities once I've gotten into a firm to focus on that area. So, you know, whether you're interested in, you know, 3D printing or BIM or parametric design or really, really technical detail drawing or whatever it is, just find what you're interested in, find ways that you can advance your skill set in that, whether that be some of these organizations that you can join, and then just become the expert as of it. Obviously, you want a good rounded education and good rounded, you know, initial experience, but becoming an expert at that, if you're passionate about it, will make life so much better. And then even as a young person or an emerging professional, oftentimes joining some of these organizations, there's discounted membership fees. And there's also scholarships available to attend conferences and attend events and or discounted fees for events. So definitely, like, if there's something you're interested in, try and make the most out of it. Join the organization, attend the conferences, and learn as much as you can.
Yeah. I know when I first joined AIA, it was because of the Paula Mays grant, and I was studying for the AREs, and it was, hey, they'll give you a whole bunch of study materials, and they'll pay for an exam, and I was like, great, that'll help me so much, but I wasn't an AIA member, so I was like, okay, I guess it's time to join the organization and start to figure out that process, but
yeah,
there's so many opportunities that way.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, check me on this, but you can get free membership to the AIA for the first 18 months after you graduate college. So there's also like learning communities within the AIA that have different topics too that you can join. And there, I think there's many opportunities. If it's something you're passionate about, look into it. You'll be able to find a group of people that have a similar passion and latch onto them and learn as much as you can.
Yeah. And I think it circles back to just, you know your passion, become an expert in it. And if it's not what you're doing day to day in the firm, you're still learning something while working in the firm, but maybe the organization can help you kind of infill gaps to become that expert, because it takes time to get to that point. You didn't graduate Kent being an expert in preservation, took project experience and time to focus on it.
Yeah. And obviously you don't want to get pigeonholed into doing things, and you still need the broad experience if you're looking to get licensed. To get all your hours. So yeah, it definitely is something that you probably need to spend time outside of work. If you are interested in some of this stuff and attending some of the events and doing some of the research, but if you're passionate about it, hopefully you're willing to do that.
Yeah, exactly. But if anybody has any questions for you on preservation or just wants to chat, is there a good way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, they can email me. Do you want me to give my email or put it?
They can contact me if they need an email. I'm okay. Not putting emails on podcasts. All right.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, well, they can email me. Feel free to reach out. Always happy to answer questions or try and connect you to the right person.
I hope you enjoyed our discussion today. Learn some advice to take with you and see how our industry is all tied together to create the world around us. Check out the description below for any links or resources we discussed. If you liked the episode, please do me a favor and hit the subscribe button. Give me a thumbs up and leave a comment below. It really helps others be able to discover this resource and support finding that career path that best works for them. If you know someone that has inspired your own career that you'd like me to interview, let me know in the comments below, or you can reach out to me via my website or LinkedIn. I'd be happy to share their story or your own. Thank you again, and I cannot wait for the next career story I get to share with you next week.